Boar would welcome very much a several weeks visit from you to thrash this out. Unless and until you have fought out the issues of interpretation one by one with Boar, I won't feel happy about the conclusions to be drawn from a piece of work as far-reaching as yours. Please go, and see me too each way if you can. So in one way, your thesis is all done. In another way, the hardest part of the work is just beginning. How soon can you come? The last few sentences in the letter must have been unpleasant for Everett, who had already lined up a job in operations research at the Pentagon starting 3 weeks later, on the assumption that, as Wheeler had previously told him, his thesis would be accepted and his degree granted by the end of the summer. But Bohr, Peterson, and others in Copenhagen were less enthusiastic about Everett's ideas than Wheeler thought. There are some notions of Everett's that seem to lack meaningful content, as, for example, his universal wave function, wrote Alexander Stern, an American physicist studying with Bohr at the time, who had taken on the task of giving a seminar on Everett's work in front of Bohr and the rest of the institute. Stern's letter gives a sense of the attitude in Copenhagen toward Everett's ideas. The basic shortcoming in his method of approach of his erudite but inconclusive and indefinite paper is his lack of adequate understanding of the measuring process. Everett does not seem to appreciate the fundamentally irreversible character and the finality of a macroscopic measurement. It is an indefinable interaction. Stern went on to claim, without further explanation, that there was no contradiction between the Schrödinger equation and wave function collapse, that the measurement problem was not a problem at all, and that Everett's claim that there was such a contradiction was not tenable. Ultimately, he dismissed Everett's ideas as either a matter of theology or metaphysics, since the extra worlds postulated by Everett could never be seen or perceived directly in any way. Despite the dim view that Copenhagen took of Everett's work, Wheeler still wanted the universal wave function and its promise of a quantum cosmology. To get Bohr's imprimatur, then, the words that went along with the universal wave function would have to change to better match the Copenhagen interpretation. Wheeler hoped for a way to retain what he liked in Everett's ideas while still using Copenhagen's language. His next letter to Everett made that clear, and also showed how much his estimate of the work involved had already changed, in light of the reaction from Copenhagen. Resolving the issues with Bohr is going to take a lot of time, a lot of heavy arguments with a practical, tough-minded man like Bohr, and a lot of writing and rewriting. The combination of qualities to accept corrections in a humble spirit, but to insist on the soundness of certain fundamental principles, is one that is rare but indispensable. And you have it. But it won't do much good unless you go and fight with the greatest fighter. Frankly, I feel about 2 more months of nearly solid day-by-day argument are needed to get the bugs out of the words, not out of the formalism, that is to say, the idea of the universal wave function. Wheeler also wrote back to Stern, vigorously defending the universal wave function, while eagerly displaying his own support for Bohr and the Copenhagen interpretation. Even more astonishing, he claimed that Everett supported the Copenhagen interpretation as well. I would not have imposed upon my friends the burden of analyzing Everett's ideas if I did not feel that the concept of universal wave function offers an illuminating and satisfactory way to present the content of quantum theory. I do not in any way question the self-consistency and correctness of the present quantum mechanical formalism when I say this. On the contrary, I have vigorously supported and expect to support in the future the current and inescapable approach to the measurement problem. To be sure, Everett may have felt some questions on this point in the past, but I do not. Moreover, I think I may say that this very fine and able and independently thinking young man has gradually come to accept the present approach to the measurement problem as correct and self-consistent, despite a few traces that remain in the present thesis, draft of a past dubious attitude. So, to avoid any possible misunderstanding, let me say that Everett's thesis is not meant to question the present approach to the measurement problem, but to accept it and generalize it. Several days later, Wheeler followed up with another letter to Everett, enclosing Stern's letter and his own reply to Stern. This letter suggests he had become still more concerned about the difficulty of reconciling Everett's ideas with Bohr's. Your thesis must receive heavy revision of words and discussion, very little of mathematics, before I can rightfully take the responsibility to recommend it for acceptance. Moreover, I think it will be humanly impossible to come to agreement on all issues unless you and I are in the same place for several weeks, or unless you and Bohr and associates are in the same place for several weeks, or both. Wheeler went on to say to Everett that he was sure that your work will receive discussions of a scope comparable to what has attended Bohm's publications. A backhanded compliment at best. Unsurprisingly, later in the same letter, Wheeler felt the need to assure Everett that he was his promoter, and one actively interested in your reputation and promising future. Despite Wheeler's insistence that Everett go to Copenhagen immediately, Everett didn't go. Part of the reason was a message from Peterson, informing Everett that Bohr was out of town until the fall, and that Bohr and his circle wanted Everett to do more work before he visited. I think it would be very helpful to us if, as a background of your criticism, you gave a thorough treatment of the attitude behind the complementary mode of description, that is to say, the Copenhagen interpretation, and as clearly as possible stated the points where you think that this approach is insufficient. While I am doing that, you might do the same for my work, Everett shot back. I believe that a number of misunderstandings will evaporate when it has been read more carefully, say 2 or 3 times. Nonetheless, Everett still wanted to go to Copenhagen, but the schedule Peterson proposed was another problem. Everett was supposed to start a new job at the Weapons Systems Evaluation Group, WSEG, at the Pentagon in less than a month, designing war games and doing operations research on nuclear strikes for the military. Spending time on a detailed reply to Rosenfeld and Bohr, in addition to the new work Wheeler required of Everett for his thesis, all on top of the day-to-day work of his new job, was just not possible. Nor was a 2-month-long trip to Copenhagen in the fall, as Peterson had proposed, for work totally unrelated to WSEG. Wheeler couldn't make Everett go to Copenhagen, but he could make him slave over revisions to his PhD thesis. When Wheeler returned to the United States at the end of the summer of 1956, that's exactly what happened. Hugh and I worked long hours at night in my office to revise the draft, Wheeler recalled later. Wheeler told his friend and colleague Bryce DeWitt that, I sat down with Everett and told him what to say. Finally, 6 months later, Everett submitted the radically revised and shortened version of his thesis with a new title, Relative States Formulation of Quantum Mechanics, which emphasized the mathematical formalism of the universal wave function and downplayed the splitting into many worlds. With Wheeler's approval, Everett finally received his Ph.D. in physics from Princeton in April 1957. His shortened thesis was judged very good and published in Reviews of Modern Physics. It appeared with a short companion paper by Wheeler, where he claimed that Everett's interpretation does not seek to supplant the Copenhagen interpretation, but to give a new and independent foundation for that interpretation. Nevertheless, the physicists in Copenhagen still didn't agree with Wheeler. Everett has some confusion as regards the observational problem, wrote Bohr to Wheeler after Wheeler sent him a copy of Everett's shortened thesis. Bohr, true to form, said he didn't have time to write down all of his ideas on the subject and promised that Peterson would write a more detailed reply to Everett. Peterson's comments were indeed more extensive and more devastating. I think that most of us here in Copenhagen look differently upon the problems and don't feel those difficulties in quantum mechanics which your paper sets out to remove, Peterson wrote. The very idea of observation belongs to the frame of classical concepts. In other words, Peterson and the others in Copenhagen thought that the process of observation had to be classical, that it was impossible in principle to explain observations using quantum physics. Instead, the world must be split in two, the classical and the quantum, and quantum physics could never be used to describe classical events like observations and measurements. But several sentences later, in the same letter, Peterson contradicts himself. He says that there are quantum effects in measurement devices, but they can be safely ignored because the devices are large. Astonishingly, Peterson uses this to justify the split between the classical and quantum, the same split that supposedly makes it impossible to give a quantum description of a measurement apparatus in the first place. There is no arbitrary distinction between the use of classical concepts and the quantum formalism, since the large mass of the measurement apparatus compared with that of the individual atomic objects permits that neglect of quantum effects, Peterson wrote. Everett spotted the contradiction immediately and called Peterson on it in his reply. You talk of the massiveness of macro systems allowing one to neglect further quantum effects, but never give any justification for this flatly asserted dogma, wrote Everett. It most certainly does not follow from the Schrödinger equation, which leads to quite strange superposition states, like Schrödinger's cat, even for macro systems when applied to any measuring process. Everett also pointed out that applying the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to measurement devices, as Peterson had done in his reply, and as Bohr had done in his replies to Einstein 30 years earlier, violated the Copenhagen interpretation's strict interdiction against using quantum physics to describe measurements. Yet Peterson and the rest of the Copenhagen camp did not address this point, and continued to ignore the criticisms of the Copenhagen interpretation that Everett had laid out in his thesis. And aside from Bohr's circle in Copenhagen, few people saw Everett's work. Wheeler sent Everett's thesis to a handful of other physicists, such as Schrödinger, Oppenheimer, and Wigner. Many did not even bother to write back. Some who did write back did so simply to argue against it, as Bohr, Peterson, and Stern had. Wheeler tentatively promoted the universal wave function at a 1957 quantum gravity conference in Chapel Hill. But the concept met with a similar fate there. Richard Feynman, who was at the conference and who had once been a student of Wheeler's himself, simply found Everett's ideas too preposterous to accept. "The concept of a universal wave function has serious difficulties," he told the assembled conference, "because it forces you to believe in the equal reality of an infinity of possible worlds, a bridge too far, even for a rebel like Feynman." Not everyone dismissed Everett's new interpretation out of hand. Norbert Wiener, the father of cybernetics and a giant in game theory, was on Wheeler's short mailing list for the thesis. He told Wheeler and Everett that he was sympathetic to their point of view. Wheeler also sent Everett's thesis to Henry Margenau at Yale, a notable dissenter from the Copenhagen orthodoxy who had been complaining about the measurement problem for years, calling wave function collapse a mathematical fiction and a grotesque claim, and protesting that measurement should not be given sacramental unction and expected to perform a redemptive act. Unsurprisingly, he approved of Everett's ideas, though he admitted that he had not had time to read the thesis carefully. Bryce DeWitt, Wheeler's colleague, fellow quantum cosmologist, and co-organizer of the Chapel Hill Quantum Gravity Conference, was skeptical of Everett's thesis at first. "I am afraid that it is precisely at the most crucial point in Everett's argument where many people, including myself, will be unable to swallow your implication. What I am not prepared to accept is the branching of worlds required by Everett's theory," wrote DeWitt to Wheeler. "I can testify to this from personal introspection, as can you. I simply do not branch." Wheeler passed DeWitt's reply on to Everett. In his reply, Everett drew an analogy between DeWitt's objection and early objections to the Copernican sun-centered model of the solar system, tinged with his usual irony. "One of the basic criticisms leveled against the Copernican theory was that the mobility of the Earth as a real physical fact is incompatible with the common-sense interpretation of nature. In other words, as any fool can plainly see, the Earth doesn't really move because we don't experience any motion. However, A theory which involves the motion of the earth is not difficult to swallow if it is a complete enough theory that one can also deduce that no motion will be felt by the earth's inhabitants, as was possible with Newtonian physics. Thus, in order to decide whether or not a theory contradicts our experience, it is necessary to see what the theory itself predicts our experience will be. Now, in your letter, you say, "I simply do not branch." I can't resist asking, do you feel the motion of the earth? DeWitt, amazed, could only laugh and say, touche. He was fully convinced, and for the time being, Everett's sole disciple. Everett, finally armed with his PhD, continued to work at WSEG and other parts of the Cold War military-industrial complex for the rest of his life, never returning to academia. It's tempting to conclude that he left academia because of his poor treatment at the hands of Wheeler and Bohr's circle, but the reality is that Everett never wanted to be an academic. He had planned to leave academia long before Wheeler's disastrous visit to Copenhagen. After all, he already had the position at WSEG worked out by the time Wheeler wrote to him after his visit to Bohr's Institute. In those letters he sent from Leiden, Wheeler implored Everett to pursue an academic career. But as with his pleas for Everett to visit Copenhagen, Wheeler's wishes for Everett's career fell on deaf ears. Everett was keenly interested in fundamental physics, but it was hardly his only interest, professional or otherwise. Everett cared about fine food, cocktails, cigarettes, travel, and women. He wanted a madman lifestyle. A career as an academic couldn't give him that, but a career as a Cold War technocrat could. By 1958, Everett was well on his way to his goal, living in the affluent Virginia suburbs of D.C., making enough money to keep him in fine style, all the while conducting affairs on the side while his wife and one-year-old daughter were waiting at home. Meanwhile, his work kept him in contact with the uppermost echelons of the nascent military-industrial complex. His work still involved multiple worlds, but now they were the many worlds of the Cold War operations researcher, gaming out different hypothetical scenarios of nuclear apocalypse. As always, Everett proved adept at his work, co-authoring an influential early study on the disastrous effect of nuclear fallout that made it all the way to President Eisenhower himself. The universal wave function was, to all appearances, far behind him. But Everett did eventually make it to Copenhagen in March 1959, 3 years after Wheeler first urged him to go. With his wife Nancy and infant daughter Liz in tow, Everett took a vacation to Europe, and Denmark was their first stop. Everett spent 2 weeks in Copenhagen, and spent a couple of days talking with Bohr, Peterson, Rosenfeld, and several others of Bohr's circle. He also visited Meissner, who was working at Bohr's Institute at the time, and who had just become engaged to a young Danish woman, Suzanne Kemp, the daughter of one of Bohr's friends. In Meissner's recollection, there were no fireworks or showdowns between Bohr and Everett. Bohr was remarkably difficult to talk with, speaking very quietly, and constantly interrupting himself and others to relight his pipe. "You didn't get the chance to say something, and then he would relight his pipe 17 times, Meissner recalled later. "It was hard to hear, you had to lean close." And Everett didn't like public speaking, so there was no opportunity for a dramatic public exchange of views. Nor would a lecture by Everett have changed much anyhow. As Meissner pointed out, Bohr's view of quantum mechanics was essentially totally accepted throughout the world by thousands of physicists doing it every day. And to expect that on the basis of a one-hour talk by a kid, he was going to totally change his viewpoint would be unrealistic. Everett agreed, albeit more colorfully. There is only one existing recording of Everett's voice, a tape of an informal interview by Meissner in 1977. When Meissner asks him about the Copenhagen visit, Everett and Meissner's laughter swallow the recording temporarily, and only a few words of Everett's reply come through. "That was a hell of a... doomed from the beginning." Bohr's inner circle simply dismissed Everett as a misguided young man. With regard to Everett, neither I nor even Niels Bohr could have any patience with him when he visited us in Copenhagen. In order to sell the hopelessly wrong ideas he had been encouraged most unwisely by Wheeler to develop, wrote Rosenfeld years later. He was undescribably stupid and could not understand the simplest things in quantum mechanics. Indeed, Bohr himself had elevated his own principle of complementarity to such lofty heights, it was a wonder he could see Everett at all from his perch. On one of those unforgettable strolls during which Bohr would so openly disclose his innermost thoughts, Rosenfeld wrote several years later, Bohr declared with intense conviction that he saw the day when complementarity would be taught in the schools and become part of general education, and better than any religion, he added, a sense of complementarity would afford people the guidance they needed. And Bohr was still unwilling to entertain the idea of a fully quantum world. The brilliant demonstration given by Bohr of the limitation of classical concepts is not accompanied by even the slightest indication of new concepts by which to replace them, complained Vladimir Fock, one of Bohr's disciples. Ultimately, the differences in aims and assumptions between Everett and the Copenhagen camp virtually guaranteed mutual incomprehension and frustration. After a long day of fruitless discussion with Bohr, Everett walked back to his Copenhagen hotel under the steel-gray afternoon twilight of the Danish sky, leaving quantum physics behind him. Drinking and smoking incessantly at the hotel bar, he was sloppy and had a cigarette all the time, recalled Suzanne Meisner. Everett had another brilliant alcohol-fueled idea, totally unrelated to the universal wave function. Jotting notes on hotel stationery while downing several pints of beer, Everett developed a new optimization algorithm for allocating military resources. It was easy to apply and fast to run on the bulky and slow computers of the time. When he returned home, Everett secured a patent for his algorithm, and it ultimately made him and his circle of military-industrial colleagues rich. Everett finally had what he wanted, a never-ending supply of booze, food, and cigarettes. Life was good. Meanwhile, Everett's quantum ideas languished. Wheeler's prediction did not come to pass. There was even less discussion of Everett's theory than there had been of Bohm's. One of the few times Everett's theory was remembered was at a conference on the foundations of quantum physics in 1962 at Xavier University, organized by Boris Podolsky, the P in EPR. This was one of the first conferences to discuss the philosophical underpinnings of quantum theory since the Einstein-Bohr debate 30 years earlier. But unlike those conferences, this conference was decidedly low profile, as Podolsky mentioned in his opening remarks. We want the participants to feel free to express themselves spontaneously without things getting out in the newspapers. After all, the foundations of quantum physics were settled, and investigating them was at best a waste of time, and at worst, a sign you were a communist. Yet there were also a surprising number of big names there. The foundations of quantum physics were still troubling to some. In addition to Podolsky, Rosen, the R of EPR, was there, as was Paul Dirac, the father of relativistic quantum field theory. So was Wigner. And while Bohm was still in exile and couldn't attend, his former student, Aharonov, was there. The conference attendees spent 3 days discussing the measurement problem, the inconsistencies of the Copenhagen interpretation, and alternatives like Bohm's pilot wave theory. At one point on the first day, discussing the trickiness of wave function collapse, someone pointed out that Everett had a theory in which there was no collapse at all. The organizers decided to extend a belated invitation to Everett, and he flew up to Xavier from D.C. for the second day of the conference. The assembled luminaries interrogated Everett. It looks like you would have a non-denumerable infinity of worlds, commented Podolsky. Yes, Everett replied. At this point, one of the attendees, Wendell Fourie, voiced his disbelief at the number of worlds involved. I can think of various alternative Fourie's doing different things, but I cannot think of a non-denumerable infinity of alternate Fourie's. The conference continued, and Everett's ideas were discussed with genuine interest for the remainder. But other than the small group of attendees, nobody knew what had happened. The proceedings remained publicly unavailable for the next 40 years, by which point everyone who had been present, aside from Aharonov and one or two others, was dead. Everett's theory slipped into a deep obscurity for the next decade, provoking almost no immediate reaction, certainly not the kind of fierce backlash that Bohm's papers had prompted. The universal wave function was simply ignored for years, while Everett himself hid in plain sight as a cold warrior. Occasionally, the idea would come up in conversation with one of his physicist-turned-wargamer colleagues. When it did, Everett was reluctant to talk about it, and he never took the debate to a larger arena. He was a dark jester, amused by paradox, perverse arguments, and private jokes. The wider stage of academia held no allure for him, and anyhow, he didn't like public speaking. He felt no particular need to remedy the physics community's misguided manner of thinking about quantum physics. That task would take a different sort of person. Not just an academic, but someone with a stronger sense of moral obligation and integrity, someone who didn't mind voicing unpopular opinions on a large stage, someone who could speak and write compellingly, and who understood exactly how to approach the problems at hand in a way that other physicists would pay attention to. It took someone who had always known Copenhagen was rotten, who had seen David Bohm do the impossible. It took a person like John Stuart Bell. 7. The most profound discovery of science. John and Mary Bell arrived to a nation in mourning. The day before they landed in California, President Kennedy had been shot and killed in Dallas. "It was the worst possible moment to have come," John said later. John and Mary, both specialists in the physics of particle accelerators, had been invited to spend a year as academic guests at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, SLAC, half a world away from their usual professional home in Switzerland. Despite the tragedy, they set to work. "Mary was quickly integrated into the accelerator division," John recalled, "and I into the particle theory group." John used the change of scenery as an opportunity to explore scientific ideas that had been weighing on his mind for over a decade. Ever since reading David Bohm's papers in 1952, Bell had known there was something wrong with von Neumann's famous proof that purportedly showed theories like Bohm's pilot wave interpretation couldn't work. Yet other physicists still regularly cited von Neumann as justification for ignoring Bohm's ideas. Shortly before Bell left Switzerland, he had spoken with Josef Jauch, a physicist at the University of Geneva, who had recently published a strengthened version of von Neumann's proof. Jauch defended his own ideas and pointed Bell toward another proof that also supposedly ruled out Bohm's version of quantum physics. "For me, that was like a red light to a bull," Bell said. "I wanted to show that Jauch was wrong. We had gotten into some quite intense discussions." Now, surrounded by the unfamiliar and stark California landscape, Bell set about doing just that. In the process, he ended up discovering a remarkable truth about the quantum world and ultimately loosened the grip of the Copenhagen interpretation on the collective psyche of physics. John Stuart Bell was born on June 28, 1928, the second of four children in a working-class Protestant family in Belfast, Northern Ireland. By his own account, he came from a long line of carpenters, blacksmiths, laborers, farm workers, and horse dealers. Bell was the first in his family to attend high school. His father had left school at the age of 8, and his siblings all found jobs by 14. By 16, Bell had graduated from the least expensive high school in the area, but the local university, Queen's, wouldn't admit anyone younger than 17, so he went looking for work. "I applied to be an office boy in a small factory, some starting jobs at the BBC, things like that, but I didn't get any of the jobs I applied for," Bell recalled years later. Ultimately, he found work as a lab assistant in the physics department at the university. "It was a tremendous thing for me, because there I met already my future professors. They were very kind to me. They gave me books to read, and in fact, I did the first year of my college physics while I was cleaning out the lab and setting out the wires for the students. Toward the end of his formal studies at Queen's, Bell had his first encounter with the mathematics of quantum physics and the Copenhagen interpretation that invariably accompanied it. He was not happy with what he found. You could learn about the periodic table of the elements, all the practical aspects of the theory, Bell recalled. Then the puzzles start. Bell's instructors and textbooks were vague about the nature of the wave function itself. They were never clear whether it, the wave function, was something real or just some kind of bookkeeping operation. And if the wave function was just a bookkeeping device, just information, then whose information was it? And if there really was no quantum world, as Bohr had insisted, then what was that information about? Bell even got into an argument with one of his instructors. I was getting very heated and accusing him more or less of dishonesty. He was getting heated too and said, "You're going too far." But I was very engaged and angry that we couldn't get all that clear. Frustrated, Bell started reading works by the founders of quantum physics in hopes of clearing up his confusion. What he found there was not particularly helpful. Bohr was unclear about where the division between the quantum and the classical world lay. Bohr seems to have been extraordinarily insensitive to the fact that we have this beautiful mathematics, and we don't know which part of the world it should be applied to, said Bell. Bohr seemed to think he had solved this question. I could not find the solution in his writings. But there was no doubt that he was convinced that he had solved the problem and, in doing so, had not only contributed to atomic physics, but to epistemology, to philosophy, to humanity in general. And Heisenberg's writing was perfectly obscure to Bell. The measurement problem was clearly a serious issue, but the Copenhagen interpretation treated it like it was trivial. Bell wanted rigor and honesty. Instead, his deep questions were waved away with insubstantial answers. Then Bell encountered von Neumann's proof, really Max Born's account of von Neumann's proof, since Bell couldn't read German. I was very impressed that somebody, von Neumann, had actually proved that you couldn't interpret quantum mechanics in some other way, Bell said. So he moved on. For me, it was a big risk that I would get hung up on these questions once I learned about them. I rather deliberately walked away from them, Bell recalled. I had the feeling then that getting involved in these questions so early might be a hole I wouldn't get out of. After graduating from Queen's, Bell found a job with the Atomic Energy Research Establishment in Harwell, England, working on nuclear reactors with Klaus Fuchs, a veteran of the Manhattan Project. But several months after Bell arrived, Fuchs confessed to passing atomic secrets to the Soviets, and Bell was reassigned to the Accelerator Physics Division. While there, he met Mary Ross, a fellow physicist and his future wife. And it was while John and Mary were working at Harwell that John encountered Bohm's pilot wave papers in 1952, shortly after they were first published. Bell was shocked by the chilly reception that Bohm's ideas received. For 25 years, people were saying that alternatives to Copenhagen were impossible. After Bohm did it, some of the same people said that now it was trivial. They did a fantastic somersault. After reading Bohm's papers, Bell immediately recognized that von Neumann's proof must be wrong. But it still wasn't available in English. So he found a colleague at Harwell who spoke German, Franz Mandel. "Franz told me something of what von Neumann was saying," Bell recalled later. "I already felt that I saw what von Neumann's unreasonable axiom was." But von Neumann's proof wasn't published in English for another 3 years, and by the time it was, Bell had started entirely different work for his PhD. When Bell arrived at graduate school, his PhD advisor, Rudolf Peierls, asked him to give a talk on what he'd been working on lately. Bell said he could talk about either accelerator physics or interpretations of quantum physics. Peierls told him he would much prefer Bell give his talk about accelerators. Bell complied, and for the next few years he stayed away from questions about the meaning of quantum physics. Several years later, Bell met Bohr himself at CERN, the European Laboratory for Particle Physics, best known today as the home of the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland. The Bells had just started working there, and Bohr was among the many luminaries who arrived for the inauguration of the then new research center. Bell ran into Bohr in an elevator and wasn't sure how to talk to the living legend. "I didn't have the nerve to say, 'I think your Copenhagen interpretation is lousy,'" he recalled later. "Besides, the lift ride wasn't very long. Now, if the lift had gotten stuck between floors, that would have made my day. In which way, I don't know." When the Bells arrived for their sabbatical in California 3 years later, Bell took the opportunity away from his usual work at CERN to finally figure out where von Neumann had gone wrong, and to show up Jauch. He found that von Neumann's revered proof, consistently invoked to defend against any heresy, was hardly a proof of anything at all. "The von Neumann proof, if you actually come to grips with it, falls apart in your hands," said Bell. "There is nothing to it. It's not just flawed, it's silly." The great John von Neumann, as it turned out, had simply made a mistake. He made assumptions in his proof that were entirely unwarranted. When you translate von Neumann's assumptions into terms of physical disposition, they're nonsense. The proof of von Neumann is not merely false, but foolish. Bell didn't merely show von Neumann and Jauch were wrong. He left a new proof in place of the old ones. Von Neumann's proof and its ilk, including Jauch's strengthened proof and the proof Jauch had mentioned to Bell by Andrew Gleason, purported to rule out any interpretation of quantum physics that used so-called hidden variables. A hidden variable's interpretation assigns definite locations or other properties to quantum objects before they are observed, even if those properties can't be calculated from the theory itself. These properties go unseen in the mathematics of quantum physics, hence hidden variables. Bohm's pilot wave interpretation is a prime example of such a theory. In Bohm's world, particles always have positions, even though those positions are largely hidden from view and can't be calculated from Schrödinger's equation. The proofs of von Neumann, Jauch, and Gleason all suggested that this kind of scheme must be impossible. Yet Bohm's pilot wave interpretation clearly worked, as Bell knew quite well. Something must be wrong, and Bell thought he knew what it was. He meticulously disassembled the no hidden variables proofs, delicately prodding at their component pieces until he found one that easily snapped in half, an unjustified assumption at the foundation. Turning this assumption on its head, Bell showed that the purported no hidden variables proofs collectively suggested something else entirely, something the original creators of these proofs did not intend or fully understand. Specifically, Bell found that a hidden variables theory could avoid the traps laid by these proofs if it had a rather peculiar property, later dubbed contextuality. Contextuality means that the outcome of a measurement on a quantum system depends on the other things you measure about that system at the same time. In other words, if you measure a property of a thing, the outcome of your measurement can depend on what other stuff you measure about that thing at the same time. In a contextual world, if you measure the energy of a neutron along with its momentum, you'll get an answer about the neutron's energy. But if you had measured the energy along with the location, you could have gotten a completely different answer about the neutron's energy, simply by virtue of the context in which you made the energy measurement. To get a better handle on contextuality, let's forget about neutrons, and instead talk about something larger and more familiar, a roulette wheel. Imagine your friend Flo is at a roulette wheel in a casino, and you're talking with her over the phone. You can't see the wheel, but you can ask her questions about how the ball landed in the wheel after any particular spin. You can ask whether the ball landed on an even or an odd number, a high or a low number, or a red or black number. Roulette wheels are constructed in such a way that half the numbers are red and half are black. But they're not split along even odds or high lows. Half the highs and half the lows are red, and the same is true for evens and odds. See figure 7.2. But Flo is being strangely reticent to tell you what's happening at the casino. For any spin of the wheel, she'll only tell you the answers to two of your questions, not all three. Normally, you wouldn't think this mattered. No matter what Flo tells you, the ball landed in a particular spot on each spin. Therefore, even though the ball's actual state is hidden from you, the answers to all three of your questions are already set once the ball stops moving. If the ball lands on 34, then the ball landed on a high, even, red number, even if Flo will tell you only two of those three things. But if the roulette wheel is contextual, all that goes out the window. For a contextual roulette wheel, the answer to the question, is the ball on a red number, depends on what else you ask at the same time. Say you ask whether the ball is on a red number and whether it's on an even number after a particular spin of the wheel. As it turns out, the answer to both your questions is yes. But if you had asked different questions after the same spin of the wheel, if you had instead asked whether the ball is on a red number and whether it's on a high number, both answers would have been no. Somehow, the answer to the question, is the ball on a red number, is actually affected by which other question you ask. This is contextuality. The answer to a question depends on its context of surrounding questions asked at the same time. In demolishing the no hidden variables proofs, Bell also demonstrated that quantum physics describes a contextual world. At first blush, the fact that quantum physics is contextual seems to support the Copenhagen interpretation, or something like it. If the answers to questions depend on the other questions asked along with them, doesn't that suggest that there are no answers to questions until they're asked? After all, if the quantum world is contextual, it can't really be like a roulette wheel. There can't be a ball that's on a particular number, passively waiting for us to look, because the properties of the number depend on what we ask about it. The color of a roulette number doesn't change when you ask whether the number is odd. 34 is red, whether or not you ask anything at all about it. Thus, in the quantum world, there can't be a roulette ball until you look for it. As Pascual Jordan said, we ourselves produce the results of measurement. Despite the appeal of this Copenhagen-ish argument, Bell handily dismissed it in a judo-like maneuver by citing Bohr himself. In the same paper where Bell established contextuality as a key feature of the quantum world, he also pointed out that contextuality shouldn't be a surprise because, as Bohr said, it's impossible to draw any sharp distinctions between the behavior of atomic objects and their interaction with the measuring instruments. You can't look at the quantum world without altering it. But that doesn't mean the quantum world isn't there before you look. Quite the opposite. If it weren't there, you wouldn't be able to alter it by looking. A contextual roulette wheel can exist. It's just that the ball's location will change when you look at it in different ways, because you can't separate the behavior of the ball from its interaction with you when you look at it. That doesn't mean the ball doesn't exist, or that it doesn't have a location before you look. It just means the ball is kind of jumpy and sensitive, moving around dramatically at even the slightest disturbance. The hidden variables in Bohm's pilot wave interpretation behave in exactly this way. Particles, according to Bohm, always have positions, but those positions can be dramatically altered by small disturbances and changes in experimental setups. Ask a slightly different set of questions to an electron in Bohm's world, and you can get an enormously different set of answers. But the electron has a definite position all the while. And because Bohm's theory is contextual, it evades all of the proofs that supposedly rule it out. What is proved by impossibility proofs, concluded Bell, is lack of imagination. despite his definitive demonstration that Bohm's theory was not impossible, Bell was still concerned about the strangest feature of pilot wave theory. It was hideously non-local. "Terrible things happened in the Bohm theory," said Bell. "For example, the paths of particles were instantaneously changed when anyone moved a magnet anywhere in the universe." Was the non-locality in Bohm's theory an essential feature of quantum physics? Bell asked this question at the conclusion of his paper demolishing von Neumann's proof, leaving it unanswered as a possible avenue for future work. Nobody saw Bell's question about non-locality for a long while. His paper demolishing von Neumann's proof spent 2 years sitting in an editor's desk due to a series of clerical errors. But Bell couldn't leave the question alone. He wanted to know the answer now. For his next project, he set about finding it. "I knew, of course, that the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen setup was the critical one for non-locality, because it led to distant correlations," Bell recalled later. "So I explicitly set out to see if in some simple Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen situation, I could devise a little model that would compute the quantum mechanical picture and leave everything local." In his work, Bell used a simplified version of the EPR setup, devised by Bohm in the textbook that he'd written just before developing his pilot wave interpretation. Bohm's version of the EPR experiment made the whole thing easier for Bell to play around with in his head. Instead of two particles colliding and flying away from each other with entangled momentum, Bohm's version of EPR involved photons with entangled polarization. Polarization is a property of light. Light is an electromagnetic wave, and the polarization is the direction that the wave is doing its waving in. But for our purposes, all that really matters is that it's directional. Polarization is sort of like a little arrow that each photon carries with it that can point in different directions. But it's not quite that simple. For one thing, we can't actually tell what direction a photon's polarization arrow is pointing. All we can do is measure a photon's polarization along one particular axis at a time, in a somewhat indirect manner, by shooting it at a polarizer, like a lens in a pair of polarized sunglasses. When a photon hits a polarizer, it either passes through or gets blocked. The closer the photon's polarization is to the polarizer's axis, the more likely it is to pass through. In Bohm's version of EPR, two photons with entangled polarization go flying off in opposite directions from a common source toward two polarizers. The two polarizers are set to measure polarization along the same axis. Because the photons have entangled polarization, when they arrive at the polarizers, they will always do the same thing. They'll both either be blocked by the polarizers or pass through them. It doesn't matter what axis the polarizers are set to, as long as the polarizers' axes match, a pair of entangled photons will always do the same thing at both of them. And, crucially, it doesn't matter how far apart the polarizers are, either. The two photons will always pass through together, or be blocked together, regardless of distance. And this is just as quantum physics says it should be. The single wave function shared by the two entangled photons guarantees that they will always behave in the same manner when encountering two polarizers with matching axes. But that wave function does not specify what they will do, merely that they will do the same thing. Now, Einstein's forced choice, the one he had feared was obscured in the EPR paper itself, comes out in vivid relief. Assuming that nature is local, then the only explanation for the perfectly synchronized long-distance choreography of the entangled photons is that they have a prearranged dance routine, one that they agreed upon before flying off from their common source. But the wave function shared by entangled photons says nothing about any kind of prearrangement. It just guarantees that the photons will always do the same thing at polarizers with the same settings, that they will be perfectly correlated. Therefore, if nature is local, the wave function is not everything. There must be hidden variables. So either quantum physics is incomplete, or nature is non-local. We cannot have both locality and completeness in quantum physics. This is Einstein's forced choice, the heart of the EPR argument. Bell toyed with this EPR Bohm thought experiment, trying to construct a model that would maintain all the predicted results of quantum physics while remaining purely local. "Everything I tried didn't work," Bell said. "I began to feel that it very likely couldn't be done. Then, I constructed an impossibility proof." Einstein had proven that quantum physics must choose between locality and completeness. But Bell's impossibility proof showed that the choice is actually between locality and correctness. Starting from the assumption that nature is local, Bell derived an inequality, a mathematical condition that any local theory of nature has to meet. Then, Bell shrewdly altered Bohm's version of the EPR thought experiment to create a situation where the predictions of quantum physics violate that inequality. Bell's stroke of brilliance was to consider imperfection rather than perfection. After all, the perfect correlations in the EPR Bohm setup are easily compatible with locality. The photons could be sharing hidden instruction sets at their common origin. But if you rotate the axis of one of the polarizers, quantum physics predicts that pairs of entangled photons arriving at the polarizers will no longer behave in exactly the same way every time. And Bell showed that the imperfect correlations predicted by quantum physics were too strong for any local theory of nature to be able to account for them. So, either the predictions of quantum physics are wrong and nature can be local, or quantum physics is right and spooky action at a distance is real. Bell had discovered a remarkably profound and counterintuitive truth about the world. Bell had also shown that there was an experimental test that could decide between the two options. All someone had to do was actually construct and perform Bell's modified version of the EPR thought experiment, or another experiment along those lines involving entangled particles. If the results showed that Bell's inequality was violated, quantum physics was safe, but nature was non-local. If his inequality held, then quantum physics was wrong, but nature could be local. Bell's impossibility proof had taken the question of non-locality out of the realm of debate and turned it into an experimental challenge. This proof, now known as Bell's theorem, has rightly been called the most profound discovery of science. Bell's result is both unexpected and problematic. Locality is a basic assumption of physics, and indeed all of science. Without locality, it would be difficult to perform any controlled experiments at all. No matter how well you control the surroundings of your experiment, there would always be the possibility of a far distant, instantaneous influence affecting your results. Einstein, in particular, emphasized that locality must be a core principle of science, not given up unless absolutely necessary for exactly this reason. Without such an assumption of the mutually independent existence, the being thus of spatially distant things, an assumption which originates in everyday thought, physical thought in the sense familiar to us would not be possible, he wrote. Nor does one see how physical laws could be formulated and tested without such a clean separation. The complete suspension of this basic principle would make impossible the idea of the existence of quasi-closed systems, and thereby the establishment of empirically testable laws in the sense familiar to us. Even putting Einstein's philosophical concerns aside, Einstein's scientific work made it clear that locality was a key feature of the world. According to Einstein's special relativity, physical objects can't be pushed up to or past the speed of light, on pain of a whole host of paradoxes involving infinite energy. You might try to get around this by finding something that is already moving faster than light, but no such object has ever been found. Indeed, relativistic particle physics states that such objects would be spectacularly unstable, precluded from existence by their own special infinite energy paradoxes. And even if you somehow get around these problems and manage to send a signal faster than light, you still run the risk of paradox. Relativity dictates that merely sending a faster-than-light signal would immediately make it possible to construct a tachyonic anti-telephone that would let you send messages back in time. But Bell's theorem doesn't mean we call ourselves yesterday or send a DeLorean to 1955. Bell and others later proved that it was impossible to use quantum entanglement for faster-than-light signaling, and the specific sort of non-locality displayed by entangled particles is so delicate and subtle, appearing only under such specific conditions, that it doesn't pose the sort of existential threat to science itself that Einstein had feared. But the fact remains that in a world where special relativity has easily passed every single test we've thrown at it, a world that appears local, the specter of non-locality raised by Bell's theorem is profoundly disturbing. If the quantum prediction for Bell's experiment is correct and Bell's inequality is violated, then something is non-local, and non-locality is merely an illusion. That suggests a need for a radical revision of our conception of space and time, far beyond Einstein's relativity. Any story of the world that could incorporate a violation of Bell's inequality would have to be truly strange. How could Bell possibly prove something so unexpected and so vast in its implications? To fully understand his proof, we'll need more than a roulette wheel. We'll need a whole casino. If you aren't interested in following the details of the proof, feel free to skip the next section entirely. It won't affect your ability to understand any of the rest of this book. But following through the argument in the next section will give you a greater understanding of how Bell proved what he did. A new casino has opened up in the small town of Belleville, California, in the sparsely populated northeastern corner of the state. And it's owned by Ronnie the Bear, who is suspected of having mob connections. Fatima and Jillian, two inspectors from the California Gaming Bureau, head up to Belleville to check out the casino before it opens, because they know Ronnie is probably up to something. Ronnie's casino floor has an overcomplicated roulette setup, possibly to impress the inspectors. In the center of the room is a large machine, with a chute extending from each side to the roulette tables at either end of the floor. At each of the two roulette tables, there are three roulette wheels, with a smaller spinning dial in the center. In accordance with state law, the roulette wheels only have alternating squares of red and black on them, not numbers. Roulette wheels with numbers on them are illegal in the state of California. See figure 7.3. Once Fatima and Jillian are each seated at one of the tables, Ronnie presses a button on the machine, and a roulette ball appears in each of the chutes, rolling toward the tables. The inspectors spin the center dial while the balls are en route, and each roulette ball lands automatically in whichever wheel is selected, eventually settling on a red or black square. See figure 7.4. Jillian and Fatima do this many times over to inspect the properties of these wheels thoroughly, and they take detailed notes on the outcomes, which wheel was used, and what color came up on each run. Black and red show up in roughly equal proportions, and after several dozen runs, the inspectors go back to their office to compare their notes. The inspectors find that each table's roulette wheels really do seem completely random. Red and black each come up almost exactly half the time. But there are strange correlations between Fatima's notes and Jillian's notes. Each time the small dials at the two tables selected the same wheel number, the two roulette balls landed on the same color. For example, on run 87, both dials pointed to wheel 2, and both roulette balls landed on red. See figure 7.5. The inspectors conclude that the balls are pre-programmed in the giant roulette ball machine to ensure they always land on the same color when they go to matching wheels. But then Fatima notices a second pattern in the results. When Fatima and Jillian didn't use corresponding wheels, they only got the same outcome 25% of the time. Fatima doesn't think that this can be right. She writes out the 8 different possible instruction sets that the roulette balls can be carrying. See figure 7.6.